Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So this is a class based on a few chapters of Srimad Bhagavatam's third canto. Apparently, a minor passage in Srimad Bhagavatam, apparently what's being presented is a mundane topic. Someone is trying to get his daughter married. But actually, what is highlighted in this encounter between Swayambhuva Manu, the first Manu, and Karadama Muni, one of the first Prajapatis, or sages who populate the universe, what's highlighted in their encounter is something of practical spiritual importance. Especially for us in the modern age, it's relevant. It's a timely topic. What is highlighted in their conversation, in their meeting, Manu and Kardama, is how the cultured members of the different orders of society, the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, how they deal with each other, how they cooperate, and how the cooperation between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas is the actual basis of the solidity of progressive human civilization. Now, of course, Bhagavatam is a purely spiritual scripture. Other Vedic literatures, do you have a chair? There are some chairs in the front. If you want to, if you don't want to sit in the front, you can take the chair or sit there. It's no problem. And we can get more chairs. It's no problem. Could someone go get a few more chairs? Okay, you bring one. The very second verse of the Bhagavatam states, Dharma projita kaitavo paramo nimatsaram nam satam. Dharma projita kaitavo. In this Bhagavatam, all kinds of cheating religion are rejected or kept out. There are many Vedic literatures that deal with relatively mundane topics. The Dharma Shastras are a whole class of literature that describe how to organize ordinary human civilization among people, for people who have all sorts of material desires and are not purely spiritual in their motives. The Dharma Shastras explain how to live peacefully, what are the proper standards of civilized human behavior, how to resolve conflicts, how to punish people who break the law. These are all described in the Dharma Shastras. But Bhagavatam is not a Dharma Shastra. Bhagavatam is Paramahamsa Samhita. Paramo Nimatsaranam Satam Vedyam Vastu. The topic, subject matter of Srimad Bhagavatam is meant for the Paramahamsas. They'll understand, and it's for them that this book is written. In other words, Bhagavatam just presents the principles of pure Bhagavad Dharma, pure devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So why, this is an interesting question, why are these things like Swayambhuva Manu trying to get his daughter married, why are these things being discussed in the Bhagavatam? Well, Bhagavatam, although it teaches pure devotional service, it's addressed to us conditioned souls in the material world. It describes the creation of the material world. It describes the different dynasties of sages, demigods, and kings who generate the population of this world. So, practical things are discussed. Material life is dealt with. What Bhagavatam teaches us is how the person who is entrapped in material life, how to change his life into spiritual life, how to become Krishna conscious. When Prabhupada first came and started into the West and started ISKCON, he first of all encouraged us to just take pure Krishna consciousness. Chant Hare Krishna. First he asked us to chant 64 rounds a day. Chant 1 lakh. And then we couldn't do that, so we tried 32 for a short time and then said, okay, chant 16 rounds every day. And that will make your life perfect. You just chant Hare Krishna, all problems will be resolved. We'll be able to live peacefully together and save the world. He's going to go out and transform the world. That was Prabhupada's mission. That was his intention. You just chant Hare Krishna and follow the basic regulative principles. Cooperate together to try to preach. And you will become automatically Brahmins and Vedas and Brahmins. Pure Vaishnavas. And the world will change. That's Prabhupada's mission. That's what he intended. And because it's the pure devotee's mission, it will happen. But we, practically we seem to be encountering some obstacles in the way of, in the path of realizing that mission of Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada also anticipated that. Prabhupada's predecessors, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and Bhaktivinoda Thakur, they understood the difficulty of promoting pure Krishna consciousness in the modern world. Therefore, even before Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati founded the Gaudiya Math, his father was telling him, we have a letter from 1912, before the founding of the Gaudiya Math, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati is being told by his father, among other things, telling him about the need to develop Sridham Mayapur and spread the glories of Mayapur all over the world. And then he says also that I'm giving you the mission of reestablishing Daivi Varnashram. This is needed. We have to reorganize even the society of devotees on the basis of the ancient social system. So our acharyas, beginning with Bhaktivinoda Thakur, saw the need to reestablish the ancient Vedic social system as part of the program of giving the world, the whole world, pure Krishna consciousness. And then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur started, Bhaktivinoda Thakur gave the idea and the order. It was his vision, what needed to be done. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, when he founded the Gaudiya Math, the first in 1918, he put into practice, at least began to put into practice, the desire of his father to reestablish Daivi Varnashram, to reorganize devotees on the basis of the ancient social system. Previous to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's preaching, the Gaudiya Vaishnavas were mostly practicing as Babaji's, those who were fully dedicated practitioners, the renounced ones. They didn't take sannyas, they put on Babaji Vesh, which is considered Paramahamsa state. Just like Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, they were householders before, but they didn't take formally the sannyas order. They simply dressed themselves in tatters, wearing white, and they acted as Paramahamsas. They didn't. They just ignored the social system. And that was the practice for 400 years after that of almost all the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. The Rihastas were there, but they were considered on the fringe. The serious, hardcore devotees were the Babaji's. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati changed that. He organized a Gaudiya Math in which the devotees dressed themselves and acted following various rules as brahmacharis, grihastas, and sannyasis, vanaprastas also. And a few of his disciples, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, gave the Babaji order to. But basically, he had them wearing saffron, white, and acting according to different rules, according to the basic principles of the ancient system. of Varnashram. Anyway, we know, therefore, and then Prabhupada, of course, carried this over to ISKCON. ISKCON was started also on the basis of devotees identifying themselves as belonging to one of the ashrams, either brahmachari or grihastha or sannyasi or vanaprastha. And we know that we have different responsibilities, different regulations, and different privileges for each of the different ashrams. This is our common experience in ISKCON. We know about this. This we inherited from Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati's preaching endeavor. But that's only half the system. It's Varna Ashram system. What hasn't been established, and what Prabhupada considered the unfinished part of his preaching endeavor, was to establish the whole system, including the Varnas, to organize even the devotee community into Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, although nobody wants to be called a Shudra. We're looking here now at what something that happened way back at the beginning of creation. Swayambhu Brahmanu, at least beginning of the day of Brahma, maybe not the beginning of the original creation of the universe, but on a particular day of Brahma, let's see, this is the third canto, so there's probably still the very first day of Brahma, probably, up through the first two cantos, according to the description given in the Bhagavatam, the events are to be described at the very first day of Brahma in his life. But at the very end of the second canto, it says, I've been describing very first kalpa, Padmam Kalpam Atoshrinu. One of the very last verses in the second canto. Now, please listen about the Padma Kalpa, which is actually the current day of Brahma we're living in now. It's the first day of his 51st year. He's halfway through his life. It's about 10:30 in the morning. In Brahma's time, it's about 10:30 in the morning now. At the beginning of his 51st year. He's just over the hill. This is the Padma Kalpa, particular day in the halfway through Brahma's life. And that's what's being described in the third and fourth canto, and probably the rest of the Bhagavatam too. So here we are, Lord Brahma is middle-aged, but it's the beginning of his day. So in the local cycle of the Divya Yuga, it's the beginning of Satya Yuga, beginning of his day. And the very first of the 14 Manus who appear in that day, Swayambhuva, born from Brahma himself, he is described there in the third canto that Swayambhuva and his wife Shatarupa are the first creatures born in this universe who were engaged in sex. Brahma created his mind-born sons without having any connection with any wife. Just like Brahma himself was born directly from the body of Narayan, without any participation of Goddess Lakshmi. Similarly, Brahma, without a wife, created 10 and then 11, including Narada, sons from his own body. They're called his mental sons. So there's no sex involved up to then. But to continue the rest of the populating of the universe, and because the living entities mostly came into this world to indulge in sex, therefore Manu and Shatarupa began the process of populating the universe by sexual combination. Anyway, that's material life. Most people who are living in this world have come here because of material desire. And the most prominent material desire is the desire to have sex. So material life begins with this Maituni Bhava, this attraction between man and woman. Krishna says in the Gita, Dharmavi Rudo Bhuteshu Kamosmi Bharatarshava. I am sex that's among the conditioned souls, sex that's not against religious principles. This is one of Krishna's opulences, his material vibhutis. Of course, it doesn't make material sex something transcendental, any more than the shark or the other material offerings among fish and the shark. It doesn't make the shark spiritual. But still, when this sex attraction is utilized for Krishna's service, then it can be considered advantageous. It's religious. Okay, it's religious, but Bhagavatam doesn't deal with mundane religious principles. Why is the Bhagavatam talking about how Swayambhuva Manu got his daughter married? What's the relevance to the discussion of pure devotional service? Well, the creation of this universe is one of the personality of Godhead's pastimes. It's not... Vishnu's creating the world for us is not his most important pastime. From the transcendental point of view, we should understand that the creation of the world is the least important, the least glorious of Lord Vishnu's pastimes. Just like the government builds a prison house, and it's, you know, the government can congratulate itself, well, we spent so much money and built such a good prison, nobody can escape from it. And prisoners are being educated to become good citizens. Such a good prison. But most of the citizens, they're not going to go to that prison. It's not much use for them. They're more interested in how the government is building schools and roads and dealing with other practical problems that are of relevance to them. So the transcendentally situated living entities, those living in Vaikuntha, how the material world gets created is not a very interesting topic to them. It's not the greatest glory of Lord Vishnu. It's the least important thing he does. But we're the inmates of the material world. We're the prisoners. And for us, oh, how this prison got built. We have nice cells, television in each cell. So for us, how the government built our prison, that's the most relevant topic, interesting topic. So therefore, Bhagavatam, addressing itself to the conditioned souls, okay, in the beginning, it spends a lot of time describing the material creation. Because that's what we are all interested in, how our prison got built. So this is Vishnu's pastime and also Brahma's pastime. Brahma is the assistant. The Greek term is demiurge. He's the demigod, half-god, who does a lot of the work of creating the material world on behalf of the Supreme Lord. And of course, creating involves, first of all, Vishnu glances at the material energy. Material energy contains within herself, in dormant state, all the material elements of creation. When Vishnu glances at Prakriti, then all the elements become agitated and they separate out. Just like if you curdle milk, the whey and the solid separate like that. The elements, by the glance of the agitation of the glance of Vishnu, they all separate. And then these elements, with their presiding demigods, with the help of Vishnu, they combine, and the different planets are created, situations for life. But in order to fill up, to finish the work of creation, the world has to be populated. It's very nice we've built all these nice planets, and we have all the different species of life available. But it's just like building a housing development. The contractors are not going to want to spend a huge amount of money unless they know that somebody wants to move into these houses. Actually, the material nature is very economical. Just like a construction company that doesn't want to spend money unless they know they're going to make a profit. So material nature never creates a body, any kind of material body, until she knows that somebody wants to occupy that body. The first material manifestation, the Mahatattva, is not created until there's a living entity who wants to occupy the Mahatattva as his body. The house is not built until somebody is ready to buy the house and move into it. Not that the constructor says, go ahead and build 5,000 houses, not knowing if anybody will buy them. First they sell the houses, and then they build them. So Maya has sold the Mahatattva to the first living entity, Brahma. We think of Brahma as taking birth on the lotus flower, but that is not his first birth. The original Brahma is the person who takes the Mahatattva as his body. This is Brahma in his first form. And similarly, all the presiding principal demigods, they take charge of each of the separated elements after the Mahatattva, the ether and so on. But still, after all this is done, all the planets are created and the different species of life are made available. Prototypes are ready. Still, somebody has to arrange to populate the universe with all these living conditioned souls who are waiting, who came in the glance of Mahavishnu. They want to get busy trying to enjoy the material world. They want bodies. So they have to take birth. So the world has to be populated. This is part of the Srishti Leela. Although it's not the most transcendental pastime of Vishnu, it's not the most glorious pastime, but it is one of his pastimes. And it is one of the major topics of the first cantos of the Bhagavatam. How the Supreme Lord and his assistants created the material world. Brahma is his first assistant, and then Brahma's sons, the Prajapatis, leaving out Narada and the four Kumaras who refused to participate in this progeny making. The four Kumaras refused. He asked his four first sons, Sanaka, Sanatana, Kumara. Who's it? Sanatana? Sanaka. Sanat Kumara. Please, you know, we need to populate this universe. Help me. We'll get married and have children. Prabhupada explains in the purport, this is the one order of the spiritual master that a disciple is allowed to refuse. The request, please get married. You're allowed to refuse. And they did. And Brahma got mad at them, and Lord Shiva came out of his forehead. And then, you know, he arranged to have other children born from his mind. The last of them was Narada, who also remained celibate. But the other sons, they all got married, and they're the Prajapatis. They're the participants in the creation, the next generation of helpers. And they helped by filling the universe with the various kinds of population. And especially some of this population are great devotees of Vishnu. And in two dynasties, particularly, the dynasty of Vivaswan, the sun god, and of Chandra, the moon god, several of the prominent incarnations of Vishnu also took birth. In the sun dynasty, Lord Ramachandra, Lord Parashuram took birth. In the moon dynasty, Krishna took birth. And other incarnations of Godhead also in these two dynasties. So these dynasties in particular, the sun god dynasty and the moon god dynasty, they're called Harivamsha, Lord Krishna's family. That kind of progeny is glorious. Therefore, the various kings and sages, demigods who took birth in these families, they're described elaborately in Srimad Bhagavatam. Vamshanucharita. The narrations about the descendants of these two dynasties, especially, is one of the major topics of the Bhagavatam, one of the ten topics. This is spiritually important. If we hear about the great devotees who took birth in Krishna's family, about Harivamsha, then we learn about the birth and activities of pure devotees who were born in Krishna's family. That will help us become Krishna conscious very effectively. And especially if we hear about the direct incarnations of the Lord, who himself personally took birth in these families. That's the best way. Janma karma cha me divyam. If we understand, learn how to understand Krishna's birth and activities. Then we won't take birth again in this material world. We'll be liberated and we'll go back to Krishna. So therefore, the narrations about Harivamsa, about Krishna's family, about his ancestors, ultimately, this all leads up to, we read throughout the first nine cantos of the Bhagavatam about so many, especially kings, in these two dynasties. There are over 3,500, maybe 3,200 individual persons mentioned, and some of them described in great detail in the Bhagavatam. They're all, most of them are members of Harivamsa in these two dynasties. The narration, and this all leads up to, through the first nine cantos, ninth canto, we read about the descendants of Ikshvaku, son of Yudhisthira, Ikshvaku, his dynasty. And it goes on and on and on through 24 chapters of the ninth canto. So many, this king gave birth to that son, and he had 10 sons, and this, and it goes on and on and on. But then at the end, 24th chapter, 9th canto, all of a sudden, we find out that Krishna was born in that dynasty. And the 59th generation after Lord Brahma, Krishna himself took birth in the dynasty of Ikshvaku. So this is definitely part of the principal strategy of the Bhagavatam, is to introduce us to the glories of Krishna's family, because that leads directly into the 10th canto and Krishna's personal birth and activities. Therefore, the Prajapatis are glorious because they help bring this Harivamsa, this family of Krishna, into this world. They're getting married and having children. It's not like ordinary people having children. There's so many children running around in this world, and they don't contribute very much to Krishna's glories. But the members of Krishna's personal family, they're glorious. Some of them are very pure devotees, some of them are incarnations of Godhead. So, if someone like Kardamamuni, also one of the principal Prajapatis, early Prajapatis, by his getting married and having children, he's adding to the Harivamsa. He had nine daughters, and then his last child was Kapila Muni, the incarnation of Godhead. You know, yeah, we should turn the light on. Whatever lights we have, why don't we just turn them all on? It's not the fans, though. We don't have electricity? In the other room. Okay, I guess we don't need the light. Yeah, if it's... Okay, by then we'll try to get it together. Now, Kardamamuni is one of the Prajapatis. The Prajapatis are not demigods, they're sages. They're not managers, they're not rulers. They're mostly busy most of the time just meditating and worshipping, performing sacrifices and meditating. But they're Prajapatis. After meditating for 10,000 years and performing so many sacrifices, then they have some children. After performing great austerities, then they indulge in sex, but for the purpose of getting good children. These are the Prajapatis. So he's a Brahmin, Kardamamuni. Typical Paka Brahmin, not a Brahmin who's partly in the mode of ignorance, partly in the mode of passion. No, he's very much fixed in the mode of goodness. Satyayuga, proper Brahman, great sage. these sages engage in meditation. The word rishi particularly means the sages, great meditators, who brought the Vedic knowledge into this world. The Vedas are eternal. They don't have any author. Just like the living entities are co-eternal with God. We don't talk about when did God create the living entities. We talk about Brahma creating the bodies of the living entities. Vishnu sending the living entities into the material world by his glance. But this is not the beginning. When we get a body given to us by material nature, that's not the beginning of our existence. Even when Vishnu glances at Maya, that's not the beginning of our existence. We existed before that. It's just a periodic entering into the material world over and over again. The living entity is eternal. Just like God was there before the creation, the living entities all were too. There never was a time when the living entities didn't exist. So nobody created the living entities, not even God. They were there with him all the time. The Vedas also are co-eternal with the personality of Godhead. So therefore they're called aparishaya. There's no person who wrote the Vedas. Not even God. Because there never was a time when it's not that Lord Vishnu woke up one day and said, we don't have any books to read. Let me write some Vedas. No, the Vedas were always there. So even Vishnu, even Krishna is not the author of the Vedas. At least in this sense. I mean, he's the author because it all emanates from him. But not at any particular time. There's no time when they didn't exist. But the rishis are each different mantra in the Vedas, not mantra, each different sukta, which is like a poem. The poem will have several verses, from 4 to about 50 verses in each sukta of each of the four Vedas. Each different sukta, each different hymn, is assigned a rishi. We're told who the rishi is. But who's this rishi? He's not the author, because nobody wrote these different hymns. But the rishis are the ones who, living in this material world, meditated, and in their meditation, heard these transcendental mantras. Just like television program originates in Delhi or Calcutta, and out here in the countryside, it's received by these microwave transponders. Every few kilometers is a microwave tower, and the signal is passed on. So like that, the sages, in their meditation, they receive the signal from the spiritual world, and it bounces off their antennas, and it comes back down into the material world. The Vedic sages, in their meditation, receive the eternal Vedic mantras, and they speak them to their disciples, and that way they receive it to human society. So that's the credit that's given to the rishis. They're the ones who perceive the Vedas in their meditation. Prajapatis are in this rishi class. These are the first class Brahmins, who are so potent they can hear the eternal Vedic sound in their meditation. And they're so trustworthy that everybody can believe, yes, what he's saying is the original Vedas, not some concoction, not some hallucination. Some mundane person thinks that God is talking to him. He's not trustworthy. He's an insane person. He could be saying any crazy thing. But the Vedic sages, the rishis, they're trusted. That their visions, their mystic visions, are verifiably Vedic knowledge. And then in later generations, there are great Brahmins, but they're not on the standard of these sages. They may study the Vedas, they may memorize the Vedas, but they're not on this level that they can come up with Vedas that nobody knows out of their meditation. So the Prajapatis, the very first rishis in the universe, they were on this level of very elevated spiritual realization, very potent personality, very remarkable, very much sattvic. Kardama Muni is in that class, great meditator. And then he's going to have this encounter with Swayambhuva Manu, who's also a very elevated spiritual personality. Brahma is the first created being, and Swayambhuva Manu is one of his sons. So even though he's a grihastha, he's not just some ordinary person. He's also practically as spiritually powerful as Kardana Muni. But he is a grihastha and he is a king. He's a kshatriya. He's practically the first kshatriya in human society. Demigods can be considered kshatriyas, but in a subtle way. But the first real kshatriya was Swayambhuva Manu. He was the first king of human society on the earth. And Shatarupa, his wife, she was his queen. Okay, it's on. One. So we have a very prototypical encounter here then, when Swayambhuva meets Kardama. We've got the first, one of the first, not the very first, but one of the first class Brahmins in the universe, and the very first human kshatriya meeting one another, and they've got some important business to deal with that has to do with fulfilling the instructions of Brahma to help him populate the universe. And we can see, we'll study how these two persons, Swayambhuva Manu and Kardama Rishi, how they deal with one another, how they cooperate, even though they belong to different classes. One is a ruler, another one's a meditator. One's in the mode of passion, the other one's in the mode of ignorance. But they can work together. Did I say ignorance? Oh, okay, no. Yeah, so Kardama is fixed in the mode of goodness. Swayambhuva Manu is, he's working in the mode of passion. He's also very much in the mode of ignorance, but every time I say ignorance, I mean goodness. Sorry, stop me when I say ignorance. No, he's got some connection with the mode of passion because he's involved in managing. Okay. He's on his way to becoming a perfect Paramahamsa, but he hasn't reached that point yet. So the mode of passion is influencing him. Okay, so in that sense, I'm saying not that he's completely covered over by passion, but he's a king, he's a kshatriya, and that has some effect on his consciousness. But that's actually, a proper kshatriya is not just a wild man. He's influenced by the mode of passion, but he's also strongly influenced by the mode of goodness. He also studies the Vedas, and he takes very seriously the guidance of the Brahmins. So unless a kshatriya also had some sattvic tendencies, he wouldn't have the affinity to Brahminical culture. He wouldn't take the Brahmin seriously if he was just a wild man, completely in passion. But we say the kshatriyas are influenced by the mode of passion. In that sense, they're in passion. Just like Brahma, he's the presiding deity of passion, and there's some influence of it on him. But it doesn't mean he's a very passionate person. He's completely celibate, perfect meditator. But he's the first person who got involved with the mode of passion. And after him, the person who took over the mode of passion was Swayambhuva Manu, the first human king. So, there's necessity in ordinary human society to make this division, occupational division, between Brahmins and Kshatriyas. They're different classes. They're separate. If we had a purely spiritual society, this wouldn't be necessary. If we had a community of Paramahamsas, persons with no material desires, who were simply absorbed in the love of God, And it's possible to have such a community, at least a small one. There are some historical records of such things, especially among the devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. When you have such a community of Paramahamsas, there's no need to even think about Brahmins, Kshatriyas, or any kind of material designation. It's when people have material desires, when they can't live up to the perfect standard, then you have to start organizing things in the material way. Social organization. Otherwise, you can have total chaos. For pure Paramahamsas, anarchy is there. No rules. Just if you have love of God, or just like in the original spiritual community of Rajadham, the actual Prajapasis, they do everything properly. They behave, they follow all the rules, but they don't pay attention to the rules. They act spontaneously out of love for Krishna. Nanda Maharaj is acting like a Kshatriya. There are a few Brahmins in the Vraj community. The rest of them are cowherds, Vaishyas. And I'm sorry, I'm saying that Nanda Maharaj is a king. Well, he's king of the cowherds. So he's acting like a king. But nobody's thinking about, you know, what's the rules. They're not studying the Dharma Shastras. They don't go to school to learn how to be what they are. It's all spontaneous. Out of love for Krishna, they all just do the right thing. It's when you don't have spontaneous love for Krishna, then you have to be told what to do. You have to learn the rules. You have to go to school and learn, you know, don't eat with your left hand, and don't do this and don't do that, do this and do that. You have to be taught rules and regulations. When you don't have love for God, when you don't have spontaneous love. The pure devotees are motivated by pure love. They don't need any rules and regulations. They don't need any divisions of society. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he had devotees of such standard, like the six Goswamis, who could take the Paramahamsa dress and ignore all the Varnashram rules, Rupa, Sanatana, and their followers. And the Babaji's, the Babaji line, the line of practicing Raghunuga Bhakti, this is following in the practice of Rupa, Sanatana, and Raghunath Das Goswami, how they behaved. And later devotees like, not later, but like other devotees in that generation like Gopalji and his disciple Dhyana Chandra Goswami, they described systematically how to follow the Babaji path, how to practice Raghunuga Bhakti. So this is very much our Gaudiya tradition. But you have to be on that standard. You have to actually have spontaneous love for Krishna, and then you can practice as a Paramahamsa. You have to have the according to Rupa Goswami in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the Nectar of Devotion, the prerequisite for Raghunuga Bhakti is loba. That means greed. But it has to be spiritual greed. You have to be beyond material anarthas. You have to have already successfully completed the process of anartha nivritti, of giving up all material contamination, basic material contamination, including sex attraction. So Prabhupada explains, following Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, that when Rupa Goswami says the prerequisite for Raghunuga Bhakti is loba, the explanation of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta and Prabhupada is that you're free from sex desire. Then you can practice Raghunuga Bhakti. Then you can dress like Rupa and Sanatana. But most of our Gaudiya Vaishnavas outside of our line, the Babaji's, they don't agree with that. They'll take neophytes, beginners, and initiate them, give them their Manjari names, and dress them up as Rupa and Sanatana Goswami. So our immediate, Prabhupada's immediate predecessor, Bhaktivedanta Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, they took exception to this, especially Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. He spoke out very vigorously against this. It's not appropriate for persons who are still full of material desires to imitate Rupa and Sanatana Goswami. Better we take the material rules and we institute this Daivi Varnashram and act like Brahmins and Kshatriyas. As long as we're not free from material desire,